Accession number 18822, Reel 8.
George Hutchison, Reel 8.
Reel 8. And the British controlling Shanghai were called the Taipan oligarchy. Taipan is the Chinese for big wind. And the Taipans were heads of big, prosperous firms like Jardine Matheson. And they felt that the best government was no government. And so Shanghai was just became the ultimate in uncontrolled venture capitalism. That, as an example, the Annual Gazette for 1932, I just picked up a copy years later, and that's why I quote this particular year of the Shanghai Municipal Gazette. It said casually that 5,720 sick destitutes were picked up dead in the year. That meant 5,700 Chinese had died of starvation. Nobody gave a damn. And probably many more had died, but somebody, a neighbor or a relative, had disposed of the body. Nobody cared, as long as there were 3 million Chinese prepared to work for almost nothing at all. I'm sorry, stop, could you? You could enter Shanghai without a passport. There was what you might call circulation libre. The only reason why it was desirable to have a passport was that you could choose your own court of law. If you had no passport, nobody could stop you coming in and trying to make a living or getting in on import-export trade. There were terrific opportunities if you were lucky. You could be any nationality. But if there was any legal trouble, everyone with a British passport would have his case taken by the British consul. And if you're an American, similarly. So on for nearly all the expatriates. But there was one exception. The white Russian refugees who'd been driven over the Siberian border in 1919-1920 by Trotsky's forces had no passports. And they had a very thin time. All they had was a little bit of paper, a square bit of paper, on which the top was typed, former Russian. They arrived in droves over the Siberian border to a town called Harbin, which until 1905, when it was conquered by the Japs, had been a Russian town. In fact, I think administered as part of Siberia, as a district as part of Siberia. And the white Russian refugee, white meaning is a political colour, meaning they were anti-Lenin and Trotsky. Stalin hadn't appeared on the scene then, but the two strongest personalities among the Red Russians were Lenin and Trotsky. And unfortunately, General Denikin, who'd been organizing a fight against the Red Russians with, I'm afraid, incompetence and what have you, had lost out. And more than 20,000 white Russians crossed the Siberian border into Manchuria and made for Harbin, and were helped as far as possible they could be helped, but it wasn't much, by those Russians who were still there after it was about 15 years earlier the Japanese had captured Manchuria and renamed it Manchukuo. And those that had any money or jewellery hidden on their body, those that had been streetwise and clever and lucky, managed to get down to Shanghai and use their money to get somewhere, let's say Vancouver. The whole of Australia was out, not a single white Russian was allowed in. A lot of them got to Paris, actually. And some were allowed in places like Vancouver. And so eventually there was a lump of 17,000 white Russians who didn't manage to get any money out or any valuables out. And they were stuck. They drifted down to Shanghai. And they had a hell of a time. It was no money. And the Chinese, whatever jobs they tried to get, you usually found that a Chinese worker or artisan could do the same job for less. And I remember once when I was about 8 or 9, a white Russian arrived at the front gate. We had a small house in a terrace with a small garden in front. And this white Russian had tried terribly hard. His clothes were worn and pathetic, but he'd obviously tried to iron them and clean them up as best he could. And he stopped at the gate, looked towards my father, and begged for some money. And my father just refused, because my mother was terribly careful. We checked every cent of expenditure every single evening, and she put aside an education fund to get my brother and myself to Oxbridge, and she succeeded. In spite of all the difficulties, she did get both of us to Oxbridge eventually. And the white Russian said with absolute quiet desperation, "I am poor." And my father was reading a copy of the North Sea, and he just shook his head. He wasn't going to be regarded as a soft touch. If you start giving a small amount of money, word would get around, you'd be flooded with white Russians. So the wretched chap, looking quietly desperate, just moved on to the next gate and tried begging there. And if I'd had any money at all, I would have given him, because as a Russian, he looked as though he might have been a station master in mainland Russia, and was now absolutely down his luck and desperate. But I got very little pocket money, just enough to pay for one copy of a pathetic magazine. Not pathetic. There was a magazine called The Magnet, which was bought by almost every British schoolboy in the 1920s, about an imaginary school called Greyfriars. Don't know if you...
Yes.
Yeah. And I'd spent my week's pocket money on that, so I had nothing to give him. But I felt desperately embarrassed, because they looked ethnically rather like British. So we had Shanghai, and we had the Chinese hostile, and for some reason the British didn't realize until far too late that by far the most serious enemy were the 15,000 Japs in Shanghai and the enormous new barracks they were building in a suburb called Hongqiu on the northeast side of Shanghai, on the far side of the Suzhou Creek. Nobody minded them building large barracks there, because it wasn't a smart area to live. if you were on the east or northeast side of the Sucho Creek, it was sort of social death, as though most people lived in Chelsea, but some people down there like lived in Brixton, I mean, if that's a kind of rough guide. Could you stop suddenly? There we were, 10,000 Brits, 3,000 French, all living a kind of very French existence in their own little concession. More like 6,000 French, 3,000 Americans, and they were completely happy that Shanghai was administratively organized by British officers, because it led to stability and by means of the police or an extremist charge by the Sikh mounted police, and anti-European and anti-American actions were kept within bounds, and there was a labour pool of 3 million men prepared to work for nothing at all, and so the Americans were very, very happy. And then we had no less than 51 other nationals, everything, Greeks, Danes, Latvians, Argentinians. I think some communities were a few hundred strong, others were much smaller. I think there were 4 Argentinians and 2 Latvians or something like that. But it was extraordinary to see this enormous list. Practically every country in the world had somebody living and working in Shanghai, and had entered Shanghai without even bothering to show his passport, and was there under de facto British protection. And there were enormous opportunities with the import-export trade, both up the Yangtze River into central China and both abroad to anywhere you liked, import-export. And we thought that because the Japanese, if necessary, were equally hard on Chinese rioters, and they more or less de facto had taken over northeast Shanghai, we thought that it was a good thing. You know, there was somebody standing no nonsense from the Japs, that the only way to maintain law and order was by aggressive police or troop action, shortened to the point, making the Chinese too frightened to start a mass rebellion. And so we regarded the Japanese, our colleagues, or at least on our side. We never met socially. And I don't think there was much social meeting between British and Chinese. I think because Brits and Chinese mutually bored each other. The Chinese and British might respect each other for commercial acumen, capacity for hard work and accuracy and so on, and therefore it was a good thing to be part of a British firm, or even a Brit to be working up for a prosperous Chinese. But I don't ever recollect any actual friendships. There were certain formal occasions where you were required to attend and eat Chinese food, which I didn't like very much. But
were you too young to notice the events of 1927 in Shanghai?
Yes, that was the year that Chiang Kai-shek slaughtered the communist and left-wing his accordance and leveling opponents, I think. There was, I only learned about it later. We had trouble in 24, 25, 27, 31, and 33, and each time, twice we had to move from an exposed position, lock up our house very carefully, and stay with friends who weren't too keen on. But you know, they did the right thing and let us stay with them for 2 or 3 days until the situation blew over. And when I was a little bit older, I became a Boy Scout when I was about 13. And as long as you had your tenderfoot badge and a scout uniform, you'd be taken down to the Shanghai Volunteer Corps drill hall. Shanghai Volunteer Corps was like a territorial unit. And there you would stand by to try and be useful. I don't think I was ever used, but those who were bigger, stronger, and more reliable than me were sent with their bicycles on messages, whatever was necessary, from this de facto headquarters in the SVC drill hall. But the only thing I remember is being allowed to get half a French baguette, scoop out some of the inside, and fill the rest with butter and tomato sauce, which I thought was absolutely delicious. Why? I suppose the drill hall being used as a kind of headquarters, they must have had meals organised. That French baguette with butter and tomato sauce, I remember to this day as being an absolute treat. But I don't think I was ever called upon to be of any use. So I stood around in a Boy Scouts uniform, eating whenever I could. And when the trouble died down, we just went back home. The Chiang Kai-shek affair, there was a de facto British, American and French permission for Chiang Kai-shek and his troops to move into Shanghai and then do anything they liked. I think they slaughtered thousands of communists and left-wingers. And we just didn't turn a hair. I wasn't old enough at the time to go down to the drill hall, and so I never saw or heard anything at first hand. But the survivors got away 300 or 400 miles to the far side of Nanjing, which is to the southeast of Shanghai. And there, then or perhaps a bit later, this peasant called Mao Zedong took charge, and Chiang Kai-shek's troops never managed to root them out completely from Nanjing, and there began then the long march. They moved northwest to relative safety and didn't appear in large numbers until 1945. Yes. But so right up until the late summer, the autumn of 1937, the Japanese were regarded as colleagues and potential allies. So we had the Chinese are hostile to us, the Japanese, who played their cards very close to their chest, and the British, and in fact with them all the Europeans except the French. There were three main groups coexisting in Shanghai, and my because British people didn't stay in Shanghai when they reached retirement age, and because if they failed, went bankrupt, they were quietly shipped home, DBS, to distressed British subject, third class, aboard the first available boat by the consul. The only British I ever saw were in the prime of life, reasonably affluent, with reasonably well-paid jobs, and I tended to associate them with wearing evening dress, a white shark-skin dinner jacket, black trousers, stepping into a car, a status symbol car like a Buick, with three or four Chinese servants in impeccable white servants' uniforms, a uniformed chauffeur in the car, and a man, you know, affluent in the prime of life. That's regarded as what most people might be able to achieve if they were British in Shanghai. But, of course, because we miscalculated with the Japanese, they ended up absolutely broken by hunger, despair, and fear, crammed into unsatisfactory prison camps, desperately hungry, ending up with some pettiness and squabbles and cringing weakness, and the days circumscribed by keeping out of the way of any Japanese guards or soldiers for fear of a face slapping or worse, and incredibly Machiavellian plans to try and scrounge a handful of rice or a cigarette or something, and 3.5, nearly 4 years of that kind of existence. They got back to England eventually in 1946, but they were broken. They haven't been a really noticeable force ever since. Could I stop a second? No Brits in Shanghai ever learnt, very few Brits in Shanghai ever learnt Chinese. My father spoke quite good Shanghai dialect and had got a reasonable way ahead with Mandarin. He used to carry around with him a box with 100 things looking like small dice. Each one had a Chinese character on it, and he would learn those 100 characters in box one to start with, then put that away and take box two. The only trouble was that the average Briton found that by the time he reached box three, he'd forgotten half the characters in box one. But there are some people who were quite brilliant, very few. Many people tried hard, and the vast majority just said, what's the point of learning Chinese? Chinese will learn Pidgin English. And indeed, and one of the Pidgin English phrases, quite revealing, it was Ningpo Mo Fa. Ningpo is a small town about 100 miles from Shanghai, down the coast. And Ningpo Mo Fa could mean quite different things depending on the context. In fact, a lot of Chinese conversation seemed to depend on reference to some well-known story or phrase or what have you, leaving each person, each Chinese person, to draw their own conclusions, often quite different from the same conversation. And basic meaning of Ningpo Mo Fa was the illiterate, unskilled, untrained, unsophisticated peasant from mainland China who crossed the international boundary desperately seeking some kind of work. It was, although starvation wages in Shanghai was highly not at all pleasant, it was less bad than what could happen to you if you're at the mercy of one of the warlords or whatever. And another totally different meaning of Ningpo Mofa was he has done a bunk. And he's gone to Ningpo, and don't ask any silly questions. So somebody's got him to spot a bother and briskly crossed back over the international settlement and disappeared in mainland China because something had gone wrong or the police were after him or something. So that was the one of the phrases that and another phrase was rice bowl broken. That is the literal translation of the Chinese word for starvation. And those Chinese in Shanghai were doing all right, that is to say, your own personal servant. You would have to have, when I first started in Shanghai in 1920, my parents were forced to hire five servants. They were all very cheap, but unless you hired five altogether, it's a team consisting of a steward, a cook, an armor, a number one coolie, and a number two coolie. Unless you hired all five, no Chinese would work for you at all. No, they would just boycott you. So, quite a large number of Chinese in Shanghai who could speak Pidgin English, make themselves understood to the British wife who was in charge of them. They did quite well. There was food security and a certain amount of fiddling with the household accounts. They would identify with a British because it reckoned it was a lifetime security if they played their cards correctly. And some of the more affluent senior Europeans paid very well indeed and would hand over quite a reasonable gratuity when the Chinese reached retirement age. And and there were, of course, many other Chinese doing all right. Somehow had got a job. Somebody had to organize the labor, do the payment vouchers and the salaries, and there was a sort of an NCO class of Chinese, probably 100,000, 200,000, doing quite nicely, as opposed to the unfortunate 3 million who had no skills and were absolutely desperate for a job. And the affluent Chinese had the most complete contempt for the Chinese who were Ningpo Mofa, unskilled, unlettered, reduced to heaving away at a heavy weight, shouting heya, hoya. They never, ever helped their less fortunate countrymen, regarding them as a kind of separate race to be ignored and done down whenever possible. And the Chinese hierarchy went up. Those